Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace, a special guest on today's show. He's an alum of the USC School of Cinematic Arts. He's the creator and was the showrunner for AMC's award-winning period drama, Halt and Catch Fire. He's written several comics for Dark Horse. He's currently the writer for Marvel's Doctor Doom, and will relaunch Iron Man this September with artist Kafu. So it's my pleasure to welcome Christopher Cantwell back to the show. Christopher, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Like I was telling you before we started here, I'm a big fan of your work, not just because I work in IT for my day job, but Halt and Catch Fire was an amazing show. So I know that I mentioned you went to school for screenwriting. That's what you always want to do, but you were working as a marketer for Disney, right? So how did that first foothold in the door to kind of move over to the creative side of things and see the stories that you envision in your head? How did that come about?
I don't know. It's funny. Yeah, as you introduced me, I hadn't been introduced by my college credentials in a while. It was kind of nice to hear the film school come up. I mean, it's funny, right? I guess the short version is, you know, you don't get a screenwriting job as soon as you graduate from a screenwriting program.
Right.
And it took me 8 years through a pretty circuitous route to end up where we did, me and my partner, Chris Rogers, in creating Halt and Catch Fire. And I, you know, it was odd jobs. It was assistant jobs. It was trying to make indie film. It was doing short films. It was, you know, production coordinating for commercials and documentaries. You know, I almost joined the Coast Guard at one point. I almost joined the circus at one point. Like, I mean, it was all over the place. And so it all kind of ended up at this weird little Skunk Works business unit of Disney, where we were doing social media content for different Disney business units, pretty much all of them, Pixar, ESPN, the studios, the parks, basically anybody and everybody. And it was pretty nascent at that point, at least compared to now. You know, so we would come in and we would pitch video content, which was kind of the reason why I came on, but that department got built out to editorial through Facebook posting and taking over all of the Facebook pages as official Disney pages. And, you know, that was novel back then. So, and in that we brought in people with magazine experience, and that's how I met my partner, Chris Rogers. And then we both had writing backgrounds. We decided to write a pilot together. And I was more of a feature film guy, and I'd written a lot of, you know, feature work. And he was very much from the TV realm in that initial golden age of TV, you know, being, you know, the Wire and Mad Men and Breaking Bad and a lot of those shows that came out in the 2000s. And so I read the Breaking Bad pilot, thought it was amazing. And so we wrote our own pilot that got us repped, and they said, write another sample so we can try to staff you guys next season. And we wrote Halt and Catch Fire, as luck would have it. And they, you know, our reps liked it. They sent it to, at that time, there were very few places that were still doing this kind of TV. So it went to HBO, Showtime, and AMC. And we had general meetings at the first two. And in the third one, you know, I parked outside a 76 gas station and just wanted to try to stay in the room as long as possible, talking about the pilot script and the show with them and its potential. And, we went in, and it was the first time we were put in a conference room and not on a couch in someone's office. And three executives came in. They all had copies of our script, and we were kind of blown away, and things went off from there. So, you know, it really was, it was the scenic route. It was kind of an overnight success via, you know, back roads for 8 years.
Which is so interesting to hear that story, because in so many ways, it's parallel to people talking about comics, right? Like, you know, you guys, here's your first foray into that realm. And it's a script you wrote in hopes of just being staffed on somebody else's show. And you guys get your own show, you know. But it seemed maybe from the outside looking in, it seems to somebody, hey, overnight success. So many times you hear about that with people who break into comics, right? But really, mm-hmm. they've been working on it for years and years to try to break in. So a very similar kind of story. You got to put in the work, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, you know, I had no idea that when Chris and I decided to work together as partners, it was, what do we really want out of this? and we were sitting at Kohl's, the French dip place in downtown LA, because I lived down there at the time. And we said, well, let's staff together, and maybe in 5 to 10 years we can have our own cable show. That was the end game. And as in tremendous fortune would have it, that was the first thing that ended up happening to us, which was amazing, right? I mean, it was nothing short of amazing. It's such a lightning in a bottle experience, that show. But yeah, you know, when that window of opportunity finally rolled along in this way, you know, it really was right place, right time, but we had to have something to jump through the window with, and that was the pilot.
Yeah, and I've heard you describe the show as lightning in a bottle before, mm-hmm. and really on the job training for you and your partner, Christopher Rogers, because, you know, again, this is the first time you guys are really, you know, diving whole hog into doing this and to be the creators and writing on the show and be the showrunners. It's a lot to take on. And you had some veteran actors on the show too, you know, Lee Pace, you know, chief among them. Did they all realize it was lightning in the bottle? Did everybody realize, hey, we're part of something that's really special here?
No. I mean, I think obviously you're always excited when you get to create something from whole cloth. Chris and I were nothing short of elated. And it was extremely intimidating through every step of the process to be brand new guys. The first writer's room you're walking into is your own. We had a wonderful mentor in Jonathan Lisko, who was the showrunner that came on to help us run the show for the first two seasons. He was incredibly transparent. He was interested in trying to realize the best version of what Chris and I envisioned. We learned everything from him. He learned his playbook from John Wells. So we kind of come out of that school. You know, you end up with a treasure trove of actors who create this five-person ensemble along with incredible guest stars. I mean, like we had Gene Smart on from Watchmen, mm-hmm. right? I mean, like we got so many, we had James Cromwell, we had so many amazing people and that core five, I mean, they all, in meeting them and talking to them and casting them, we entered the TV landscape right at this weird point where that anti-hero model of Walter White and Don Draper and McNulty and this idea of the male anti-hero structure, Tony Soprano, was looking to be pivoted. And so the first season, and I think even the pilot that we wrote, you know, we were writing to shows we aspired to be like. And it took us a few episodes to find the show. And what we really discovered in our writer's room in this first season was we had a lot of fun writing for everybody, right? And deconstructing Joe and turning him into the kind of inverse of those characters that had come before him. And that's when things really opened up. And I think, you know, when you're in the thick of it day in, day out, I think you don't really see the forest from the trees. But I think around season two, we all started to feel like, wait a minute, this is something very different. This is wholly original. This is our own. Everybody, you know, got along. It was a great group of people. It just had a very great energy to it. And that carried through and grew through the end of the show. It was really wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, it was super compelling from the beginning, but I think you're right when you start talking about Joe McMillan, Lee Pace's character. You know, he just chews scenery up early on, mm-hmm. but it's not until maybe halfway through the first season where the cracks start to show and you realize, well, you know, maybe this guy doesn't have it all together, that yeah. I felt as a viewer that I could start to relate to him and kind of root for him in a way, because you realize he is flawed like we all are.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the two most important things that came out of the first season was when Jonathan Lisko came in, it was after we had shot the pilot. And he said, what if in episode two, we realize that Joe doesn't have, he has such a brilliant first step in the pilot where he's thought everything through. What if in episode two, we realize that that's all he's thought through and he doesn't see this one train coming that's going to blindside him and the rest of the characters. And I just thought that was brilliant, you know, and we had to, again, there was still some ironing out to do there as we move forward with that decision, but that pivot was probably the most important pivot. And then the other thing that was probably the most important thing said to me about the character that was illuminating was when we were working with Lee early on, and I think it was, God, it had to be like episode one or two, or I don't know, but he was adamant that Joe was not a snake oil salesman. He wasn't just a fiend, right? He wasn't after power. He was, in Lee's words, a zealot. He believed in what he was doing, right? It was, he believed in the truth of what he was doing and what the world was going to turn into. His flaw was that at the beginning, at least, he was willing to do anything and run over anyone to get there, because he was the one who, the scales had fallen from his eyes and he was the one who could see it. So he needed to bring everybody there, and he knew best. Right. So that was really important. It changed him from just a dirt bag.
Right. Yeah. And the other thing is that you carried so many of those themes, you know, all the way through. And I think it was either late in season 3 or early in season 4, where Scoot McNairy's character, Gordon, says something to Joe to that effect that you just mentioned. Like, man, you have this great first step, but you mm-hmm. never know, you know, you don't know what comes next. You leave it to the rest of us, you know, to kind of figure it out. Mm-hmm. So it's so interesting. Well, I do want to move on. I mean, I could talk Halt and Catfire all day.
Hey, me too, man. It's like my high school football days at this point.
Yeah, it's awesome. I do have to ask you one thing. So I came to it later. I didn't see it when it was airing first, but I have to ask that. I think it's second or third to the last episode, and I don't want to spoil for people who haven't seen it, but we lose a character, and it was impactful. At the time when it came out, was there a visceral reaction from the fans of the show that were watching it week to week?
Oh yeah, I think people that were with us at the beginning, I think they really felt that, and I think we all did too. I mean, that was something that we would uncharacteristic of TV shows, I think, walk the cast through our high level plans of where we were headed. Now, obviously, we wouldn't have the whole thing at the beginning, mm-hmm. but that was a story point that Chris and I had discussed preceding the season 4 writers' room, and it had kind of been out there, and things had been seeded since season 2, and it was a hard thing. And I think we all emotionally felt it, on the set, in the writer's room, reading the drafts, and then you see the performances, you see what, Trisha Brock did with that episode, you know, and then even in mine, which follows it, I got to do some flashback scenes mm-hmm. with that character. And they're literally the last scenes that the character's in the show. And I remember finishing shooting that with the actor and realizing that's it, that he's done. And I started crying behind the monitor, because it was, you know, you're saying goodbye to something you created with dozens of other people, but, you know, primarily your partner, your writer's room, the actor. I mean, like that it belonged to everybody. Right. And so to see it end is always hard, but it really felt like we hit the right note with that. But yeah, the funny anecdotal story is, That plot point got spoiled for my wife. I tried to keep everything from season 4 from my wife, because I wanted her to just see the last season, you know, in real time. Mm-hmm. That got spoiled right towards the end of the shooting, because I was discussing something on the phone with, it was actually Lee. I said it out loud. And I got off the phone, and my wife was like, "What? What's going to happen?" And she was really mad that she found out. My dad came out to visit me on set right before I directed the episode that follows that, because I got a kidney stone in Atlanta during my prep week for the episode, and I was hospitalized.
Oh, terrible.
So my dad came out, and he was, you know, hanging out with me and kind of like helping me through it. And, you know, I was fine by the time we were shooting, but he knew what was going to happen because he was there when we shot it. The only person who didn't know was my mom. And so for some reason, I guess they came over to watch it, but like, we all knew what was going to happen, but I kind of forgot that my mom didn't. And so we watched the episode, and we watched episode 7, and that happened. And my mom was like, "What?" And turned around like with this innocent look on her face. And she just ended up like just sobbing the rest of the night, and was crying as she left and said goodbye and got in the car. And I actually felt a little bad about it, because, you know, it's your mom. I was like, oh, I ruined my mom's evening.
Well, you know,
but I would do it.
You know, it's credit to everybody involved, like you said, for giving us characters that we cared so much about. So for me, just to give you my personal experience, when I watch it, so if you haven't seen it, it gets my highest possible recommendation. It's such a well-crafted show. It's available on Netflix. You can binge the whole thing. And when I saw it the first time, and I saw that episode, I kind of knew, like when you got to the last 5 minutes, I kind of knew with that first scene, I'm like, oh, okay, here's where we're going. Mm-hmm. This is going to mm-hmm. suck. Finished watching that episode, watched the following episode, which was yours, which was, like you mentioned, flashback and the characters reminiscing. It wasn't until the next show after that, where we see Comet and we see the commercial, that's when it got me.
And yeah.
That's when I had to reach for the tissues. I was like, oh, man, this person's really gone, you know?
And yeah, they're moving the MP on. Office and all of that stuff. It was it was rough. And, you know, like when the script for 8 came in, which is the immediate aftermath, that was written by Zach Whedon. From our staff, and he just, you know, we got that script in, and I was like, okay, great. I just set up the camera and let it go, because I knew the actors would pull it off, because they're incredible. And you know, Zach turned in such a beautiful thing, and it was actually somewhat based on, you know, similar experiences of what you do when someone passes away. Right. And it was such an interesting way in. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Well, let's talk a little bit about another show that you have coming up that you're going to be show running. I know you can't say too much. So we learned last year, 2019, a few different production companies got together. Amazon involved with doing Paper Girls, Brian K. Vaughan's series that was over at Image. Then it just got, and that was 2019, about this time of year, July or so. Now, we just learned last month, Comic-Con at Home, that you and your partner, Christopher Rogers, coming on as showrunners, Amazon's given the go-ahead to take this to series. So I know you can't say much, but what can you tell us about Paper Girls at Amazon?
Well, I think the most important thing to say is that that last summer, that the original concept for the series was put together by Stephanie Folsom, who co-wrote Thor 3 and Toy Story 4. And she put that together with Brian's blessing. The two of them went in and sold that. You know, I had read the series, so hearing that it was going to be a show was very exciting for me too, just as a fan. You know, and it was to Legendary and Amazon. You know, around, I guess, you know, late last year, they brought Chris and I in, and we opened a writer's room. We brought in an incredible group of people, and we worked on it. The pandemic happened about 2/3 of the way through, 3/4 of the way through. We had to kind of do the standing leap to the other side of the cliff over Zoom and try to finish it out. We did. And we have a great set of scripts. I'm extremely excited about it. You know, obviously we need this virus curtain to lift for much more important reasons, but when it does, we'll be able to shoot this thing and get it to people. And I think people are really going to love it. And it's been such a joy to work with Stephanie and also Brian. I mean, I was intimidated when I got on the phone with Brian for the first time. But he is one of the nicest, most wonderful, funniest, most brilliant human beings I've met. And I don't say those kinds of things lightly. So, and the same is true of Steph. So it's been fun to have a new partner, because Chris and I have been working together for 10 years. So to begin to work with Steph and that have it be the three of us, we had to find that, but it's been fun. It's been a ride in and of itself. So yeah, this will be our sophomore series effort, but one that I think comes with a really wonderful underlying legacy to it already. And I'm just very pleased and thrilled to be a part of it.
Yeah, I was wondering, because I did see that Steph was going to be kind of a third showrunner, and wondering if that was going to be a challenge or if it was going to be a case where, you know, you're adding in something new and it kind of, you know, it re-energizes everybody.
In a way, I think this is where Chris and I, we get to pay it forward. We had a tremendous partner in Jonathan Lisko. So we've been down this road before, right? Where we had a partner, a third partner when we first started. Mm-hmm. And he was tremendously gracious and giving and fun to work with, and also a good person. So we wanted to come in and if in any way we can be the Jonathan Lisco this time around, awesome. You know what I mean? And I think that Steph is obviously more than capable of doing all of this, but, you know, to come in and work with her, it's something we do have experience in, but we get to be on the other side of the line this time, but we're going to do it the way that Jonathan did it for us, if anything. So we're there to, obviously we're there to contribute and really we hope our fingerprints are all over this thing, because we like to, you know, be a part of this because it's so awesome. And Brian, obviously, and Cliff, obviously. Cliff, we want Cliff to be involved every step of the way as well, because he created this with Brian. But, you know, this is also, in terms of the TV version, this is Steph Folsom's vision of what this is, you know, and she's done it with collaboration from Brian and Cliff and now us. But she sold this original thing. She was there on the ground floor. So we're there to facilitate that. We're helping build the house, and, you know, we have some architectural background. Right. So I think it'll turn into a really wonderful collaboration. You know, I think that it's a collaborative medium, and even film is too. So we're all going to be in there, but we're there to help, you know, we're there to get it done. And, that's what we're going to do. And we're going to do it in a way that's positive, because that's how we learned. We're extraordinarily lucky. I mean, there are so many stories of creators and showrunners not getting along, creators getting booted from series, showrunners getting booted from series, you know, writers' rooms being split into two writers' rooms. We don't go that route. We've run, let's see, four writers' rooms for Halt and Catch Fire, a writer's room for a mini room for a show at AMC that unfortunately didn't go, and now this, and they've all had a really good vibe to it. And I do give Chris and I credit for that, because we're not making blood plasma. We're making TV and entertainment, right? We're not saving lives. So everybody needs to cool it in terms of taking it so seriously. Obviously there's a lot of money on the line, but, you know, it's not my money.
And you're right. You know, you guys are there to create something, you know, and you're going to put some of what you bring to the table, and Chris Rogers is going to put something of what he brings to the table. And same thing with Stephanie Folsom. And I'm glad that she's, you know, part of the team, because yes, it's, you know, Brian's vision and Cliff being, you know, the visual storyteller for the comics. But remember, this is Paper Girls. So the fact that Stephanie Folsom is on there and she's going to bring a female perspective, you know, I just think that's great.
It's essential. It's nothing short of essential. And our writer's room, we wanted to make sure that that was reflected in our writer's room as well. I think our staff was very varied in their life experiences and their identities and how they see the world. We wanted to make sure that that was paramount to how we're doing this, because not only are the Paper Girls girls, they're a diverse group of girls, and they come from all walks of life. And that's key to the show. I mean, it's a cornerstone to what this story is about. So,
and that kind of leads me to the next thing. And again, I know you can't name any names, but for fans of Paper Girls, the casting is going to be mm-hmm. important. So have you guys started down that path? Do you have people in mind? Have you been looking at people at all yet? Or is that still all on hold?
What we're really focused on right now is the writing, right? And that the most important thing to me as a showrunner is the writing. The writer's room is the show. If the writer's room isn't working and the material you're getting out of the writer's room is not working or the best it can be, everything else is going to suffer after the fact, no matter how good the actor is, the director, or the production design. And I want to spend as much time focusing on the writing. And I think I speak for Chris and Steph too. So we try not to get ahead of ourselves. I also don't, I grew up Roman Catholic, so I think I'm going to jinx myself if I go too far down the road with hopes and expectations. So one thing at a time for us, and really it's how are these scripts looking? How is this story shaking out? And that's me, Steph, and Chris figuring that out along with Brian and our producers at Plan B and Legendary and Amazon. We've got a really good a group of people on this thing that is making sure that it's going to be solid. So first things first.
First things first. Fair enough. All right. Well, let's talk some comics. I think the first time that we had you on the show, She Could Fly issue one was the only issue that was out. And you and I sat down at San Diego Comic-Con that year and we talked about it. And that series ended up being so much more than I expected. Obviously, you and I discussed Luna and the mental health issues that she had. You know, you mentioned that you had struggled with some of those yourself. But you really explored it and I think presented it in a way for people who maybe don't have an understanding of what that daily challenge is. But then you ended up wrapping it around, Russian spies and yeah. Chinese operatives and, particle accelerators that allow people to fly. So when it was all said and done and you had all four issues out of the first story of She Could Fly, how did you feel about it looking back? Was it something you're real proud of? Did you look back and say, oh, I wish I'd done this different? What was that experience like having your first comic series under your belt?
I think it's both, right? I mean, you always look back and go, even with Hulk, right? I'm like, that line, why did we keep that in there? Why was I so adamant about this? But I think with She Could Fly, it's the most personal book still. And I've gotten to do a few since, right? And it's still one of my favorite stories I've ever worked on. And there are things I would definitely go back and change because it was my freshman effort in comic books, just period. I'd never done them before. I could revise it. I try to be honest with myself. I was, as my dad would say, a kid in the candy store, I think, with some of this stuff. There was so much that I wanted to put in. I think I had not yet fully learned the distillation of story, that it can be so tremendously potent in comic books. And yet I love what we did. I mean, it was fun. It was kind of no rules. It was me and Martine, Karen Berger, Richard Bruning, who designed the book, Miroslav, our colorist, and Clem, even coming in with the lettering, designing the lettering for the scary voices in her head, all that stuff. It was just so much fun. And it was, again, it was like Halt, right? It was an original thing that it kind of just came out of my head and we got to do it. And so She Could Fly is definitely my Halt and Catch Fire, right? I mean, I love it. And, we do have a pilot for television based on the comic book. I did develop that with AMC and it's kind of out there as a free agent right now. And I'm very proud of it. And it's very different from the comic book because it has to be in a television medium. But again, it's a story that's really important to me. So, you always want to go back and screw around with things you've worked on. I might, but I'm also very proud of those two beautiful volumes that Berger Books put out and brought me into the whole world of comic books at the same time. So it's so important to me on many levels.
Well, I remember when issue four came out and we kind of got, I won't say the end of the story, but we got an ending and it did feel satisfying. I mean, so much of comics is sales driven and do the sales, warrant to go back to these characters and tell more of their story. You had an essay in the back of the fourth issue that, even going beyond what you had kind of put of yourself in the story and that we see reflected through Luna, you really kind of laid it all out on the table. And as somebody who also struggled with bipolar and mental issues at a point in my life, I really respected your vulnerability to put that out there. But it also showed me that based on the fact you're saying this, I know we're probably going to get more. But when we got to the end of the second volume, issue five, it just said end and we didn't get any word from you. So a couple things. Are we going to get more of that story? Because I've heard you mention that you would, or you have other ideas about those characters. And also kind of the same question about the first volume. Now you've told your second one, you've learned. Mm-hmm. How did you feel when the second volume was done, all five issues?
I was happy with it. I definitely wanted it to keep going. I think I wrote the first four, not knowing what was going to happen, I felt very lucky to keep going with the next five. I definitely would have liked to do more, you know, but we did stop at that point. You know, it's an indie book. The market is crazy and tenuous. But I sure as heck hope we get to do more. And I think we may have some kind of referendum on that soon, you know, which would be nice, at least for closure for my brain. But I do have ideas of where we would go next. I do know that there's kind of a bonus coda that's coming in. Fraser Brown is putting out a book called Tales from the Quarantine. I don't know if you've heard about this, but it's the big kind of anthology of one page stories based around, you know, a very similar theme. They're not literally quarantine stories about the pandemic, but because Martine and I own the IP of She Could Fly, there will be a one page story.
Oh, cool.
About Luna in that book, and all the proceeds are going to go to charity and stuff. So there's a one page coda that could act as a really beautiful little grace note, or it could be a bridge. You know, we'll see.
Well, I thought it was spectacular. Again, such an interesting way to show the challenges of, you know, mental health, and then you wrapped it around such an interesting story as well. Because, like I said, you brought in the stuff that, you know, somebody who's maybe never dealt with any kind of mental health issues can just enjoy it on that level, where, hey, this is just a really cool comic story, but at the same time, it's you know, showing people that, hey, when you're in it, you can't see the forest for the trees. You're just, you know, you're just trying to get through the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, that was a time in my life. I don't ever really want my work to be therapy or some kind of diary, but, you know, I had gone from, at that time in my life, keeping things hidden and private and unspoken for 35 years about certain aspects of what I've gone through, to, you know, writing a book with an ISBN number. And so I was like, if we're going to do it, let's just do it. Right. So, and it was tremendously helpful for me. I think it put me on a different level with all of that stuff. And if anything, allowed me to embrace it more and feel less shame around it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I'm glad, because, again, you know, we're of a similar age, and man, when we grew up, you didn't talk about it, and it's gotten so much better now. And I'm very appreciative of that. We've got Doctor Doom coming out from Marvel. It returns, I think it's issue 6 on...
7. So yeah, 7 comes out next month.
Yeah, yes. On September 23rd. Mm-hmm. The week before that, you've got a new Iron Man that you're doing with Kafu. So I wanted to talk a little bit about these Marvel series, but it's probably a good idea to talk about comics as a part of your childhood. You always wanted to write comics? Is that accurate? You grew up reading?
I mean, if I'm being honest, when I was a kid, I didn't understand how they were made. I thought that it was, I wasn't paying attention to the credits in the book, right? I was just so absorbed into the stories. They were a huge part of my life in middle school. And that was coincidentally when I was going through a lot of these mental health issues completely in private, you know, mm-hmm. on my own. So comics were really a solace for me, because with a mind that does have, you know, obsessive compulsive wiring, I hesitate to use the word disordered. Comics are great because, one, you can lose yourself in the story emotionally, but then they're so detail oriented, especially the worlds and the mythology and the characters and the statistics and all that stuff. It is like salve for my brain, where it's much more of a neutral obsession and rumination than something maybe darker and scarier. Right. I mean, I still remember being in the backseat of my dad's car, and I was like reading Wizard magazine or something. And I was trying to explain the difference between the X-Men blue team and the X-Men gold team. And my dad finally interrupting me and saying, I don't care. You know, like, it was one of those moments where he was like, I don't care about this. I don't care about this. Stop talking about it. I don't blame him, because now my older son does the same thing with Harry Potter, Pokemon. He does it with Marvel characters, and kind of, I don't know, man, tries to own me on Marvel, which is funny, because like he was, I'm like, I write Iron Man. Like, why are you disagreeing with me? But yeah, so it was kind of twofold for me, in that I could lose myself in these stories when I was feeling very isolated, especially, you know, books back then, they're all about teams, right? Mm-hmm. And collaboration. Even if you look at something like Bone, it's him and his cousins, you know, like, and Thorn, and these, and they're always just these great ensemble pieces. And when you're an only child and you're dealing with this weird stuff in your brain that you don't understand, and it makes you feel kind of isolated and disconnected and fractured, it's nice to read this stuff about these weirdos doing weird stuff together, and it's good, you know. And I loved that as a kid, and I tried to carry that with me as soon as I started writing these things, and that was She Could Fly. I think it never really occurred to me to write comics. It always felt completely out of reach, probably because I couldn't draw. I had no idea, right? It was like, I can't do that. It was just an assumed thing, even for like a precocious Gen X / millennial kid right in the middle, right? It was like, I can't do that, you know? So, but as I got older, you know, I got really, really into movies. And I just lost myself in movies. From a young age, my parents and I, we would almost go to the movie theater every week. I did the math, and I think I saw 45 movies in the theaters in 1989, and I was only 7 years old. You know, so when I got to high school, that really started to take over my mind, and I started to dig deeper. And then I turned to screenwriting because screenwriting is another way to deal with obsessions and ruminations. You know, you're focused on your story, your characters, the details, the world, and you're not focused on other stuff that's awful. So I really do think I bought the Screenwriter's Bible at Barnes & Noble when I was 15, 16 years old, because I was looking for something to preoccupy me that summer, because I was scared of having another scary, awful summer like I'd had the year before when I was not in school and left to my own mental devices, you know? Gotcha.
Well, I've heard you say that when you came up with the idea for the story of She Could Fly, you thought it would translate better as a comic, and we're lucky enough to have a connection that got you to Karen Berger, who's, you know, absolutely amazing, probably one of the most influential editors in the last, you know, 20, 30 years, you know, super advocate for creators, and a really nice person, and just, you know, passionate about the medium. I can't say enough superlatives about her. But again, with comics, it's all about connection, right? So from She Could Fly to your foot in the door at Marvel, tell us about how that happened.
Well, I had such a good time with Karen on She Could Fly, and it was so much fun working with her. I've been so tremendously lucky at working with the people I've gotten to work with, the mentors I've had that have kind of shepherded me into these different businesses, whether that be, you know, Melissa Bernstein and Mark Johnson, who produced Halt and also Breaking Bad, you know, happen to be some of the best people I've met. Jonathan Liskow, same. And then Karen, right? It's like, I just feel tremendously lucky. I'm always waiting for the other shoe to drop somewhere else in my life, right? Mm-hmm. I had so much fun working with Karen that we said, you know, let's do something else together. And then I pitched her my book, Everything, you know, about a ominous, mysterious kind of Lynchian department store in the early 80s. And that got, you know, from there, I was sitting down with, you know, Mike Richardson, in between interviews, you know, San Diego Comic-Con, just hanging out. And we started talking about The Mask, which Mike created. And then that led to The Mask. And then somewhere along the lines, Karen introduced me to Will Moss over at Marvel. And then he reached out of the blue to have me do a 10-page story for War Scrolls as part of the War of the Realms issue. And he said, would you be interested in writing a 10-page story for our anthology book? And I was like, yes. And he said, it's going to take me a couple days to make sure the character's available, so I can't tell you who it is yet. And so I had these days of wondering who I was going to get. And then he said, it's Dr. Doom. And I was like, you know, when that happens, when you're an adult, you become 12 again,
yeah,
you know, fall over a little bit. And so I killed myself writing that book. And I got to work with Sean Tormey, which was so much fun, who's gone on to do great stuff at Marvel and DC. And then Tom Brevoort reached out and said, do you want to pitch on a full Dr. Doom book? And I said, yes. And I killed myself doing the research on that. And that book came together with Salvador. And then Tom came back and said, do you want to pitch on Iron Man? And I was like, Yeah, and then I killed myself on Ironman. I mean, I had like a, you know, I was just, you talk about losing yourself in ruminations and details. It's like I turned in like a 25-page kitchen sink document to Tom about what I thought about Ironman, and I think it was my enthusiasm that won him over more than anything else. He's like, I think we better give it to this guy, otherwise he's just going to go to pieces.
Well, yeah. I know that you and I think our favorite Ironman stuff is around the same time period. So I do want to talk about that in a second, but I have to tell you, so I've never been a big fan of Dr. Doom. To me, he's always been kind of, you know, over the top and just this big blowhard. Yep. And I've had a hard time kind of relating to him, but yep, you bring, you ground him in a way that I haven't seen before. He's still, you know, over the top. He's still, you know, I love at the end of your first issue when he asks from one of his subordinates, bring me the newscaster, Steve. You know, he's still completely over the top, yeah, would do things like this, because this newscaster, for those that haven't read it, insults Doom on the air, you know, on the airwaves. But you've brought a humanity to him that I haven't seen before. When you started doing the research, you know, both for the 10-page story and then to do the full series, what was your gateway? When did he click for you and you thought, okay, I got it. I know the way I'm going to approach him as a character.
I think it was, I mean, I think I can answer that quickly, which was it's Triumph and Torment, right? Which is the Doctor Strange, mm-hmm, Doom Limited. And that was, it's explored a spiritual side of Doom and a personal side of Doom that I thought was fascinating, right? And it also explored his wizardry, his sorcery, which is this whole other part of the character that kind of gets lost in the, you know, I'm building a time machine or whatever, you know, it's like whatever it is. I'm building a finger gun. And that, so there's, he was like, I need to free my mom's soul. So if you dig for this stuff, it's there. You're like, you know, I feel like these guys in the bullpen are like, they're digging this stuff up because they got to put material out and they end up putting raw stuff in. That's what's so cool about comics, is that stuff ends up working its way in. And there's a three panel sequence in Triumph and Torment, which is when they arrive in Latveria and a child hands him a flower and he thanks the child. And you see, again, it's like Joe McMillan. He's not full of it. He loves his people. There's a thing about Doom where the thing I like to think about Doom is that he can love, but he is unable to be loved. There's something wrong with him in that way. Whether it be that his mom was taken from him, his dad was taken from him, his dad died saving him. I mean, you can go any direction with this stuff. It's these characters are kind of our Greek myths, right? I mean, that's what's cool. They're kind of American Greek myths. They're Greek gods. So they're at once stalwart and they never change. They're indelible. And also they're completely malleable at the same time. So, I love writing mock serious, heavy-handed dialogue. And I just think he's got all of it. And he's also a bad guy. So he's got a deep bag of tricks of what he can do. So he can be a softie. He can be unintentionally hilarious. He can remind you of what a bastard he is and really do something truly evil. I mean, you can go places with him and yeah, it's a character called Dr. Doom. So you, at the end of the day, you can't take it too seriously. That's what I love about Marvel. You know, I was an intern at Marvel Studios when I was 19. So it was just me. Chris Yost was my boss, you know, who went on to work in lots of comics. And I think even worked on the Thor films. Kevin Feige, I think, was 28, 29. I was the youngest person in the office. He was the second youngest. This was 2001. Avi Arad was there. And there's just so much fun, you know, like digging into I managed the comic vault with Chris. So it was like, you're reading old issues of Damage Control. And it's funny. Mm-hmm. You're reading old images of Ant-Man back when he had the swashbuckling outfit. You're like, you can't. It's that idea that, I mean, this is heady, but it's a George Bernard Shaw quote where it's like, if you want to tell people the truth, you better make them laugh. Otherwise, they'll rend you limb from limb.
Yep.
No, there's something about Marvel that they know what they're doing when they're firing on all cylinders. They get it. And I think they've perfected that formula in the movies, right? I mean, You watch Thor 3, you watch Guardians, you watch, I mean, Homecoming, I mean, it was a dream come true for me. I was laughing my ass off watching that movie, and I loved it, because, I mean, Spider-Man is, you know, everything to me. So there's a sincerity to the humor that allows you to do a sincere portrait of the human emotion. Yeah, and you can even do that with someone like Doctor Doom. I think you could do it with any lasting Marvel character. That's what's awesome about them.
Yeah, and it works. It, you know, you talk about humor. So Iron Man was always one of my favorite characters. And I know probably before the first Iron Man film, he wasn't a household name, obviously is now. And I was one of those people that when I heard Robert Downey Jr. was cast, I was like, I don't see it. I just don't see it. But I was also one of those people I was the first to admit I was wrong when I came walking out of the theater after seeing that first one. I was like, you know what? It's not my version of Tony Stark, but it's a good version, and it will work, and it will bring people into the Marvel Universe. And that's exactly what happened. My favorite run of Iron Man from about 169, where Jim Rhodes takes over as Iron Man, and then Tony has this road to redemption up through 200, gets the Silver Centurion armor, and then up through, you know, maybe around 250, right around the end of the first Armor Wars. That's like my sweet spot.
That's going to be Denny O'Neill leading into Michelini and Leighton coming back to the book, right?
Exactly.
I hope I just got a lot of credibility to your listeners right there. See, I know what I'm talking about.
Exactly. Well, and again, it's just it was at a time in our lives where, man, we were in it. We knew the different armors, and we knew, you know, it was just so amazing. When you look back, and because you have kind of your foot in both worlds, you know, the Hollywood stuff and comics, how do you feel about Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man and kind of the change that then happened in the comics where the character of Tony Stark started reflecting kind of the personalities and foibles of what RDJ did with the character?
I mean, I think he did such a complete thing with that character, and it was amazing that he was allowed to do that with the filmmakers, right? I mean, tell that story from, I mean, that is a comic book run. Mm-hmm. What RDJ did with and RDJ, Favreau, and the Russo brothers did with that character, I mean, that is a full comic book run. Like, that should be up there with, you know, Leighton and Michelini and O'Neill and these guys. Like, that's his, and that's what's cool about it. So it's yet another chapter in the tapestry. That's mixing metaphors. Tapestries don't have chapters. But you know, it's another piece of that. So, you know, when it's influential, of course it's going to find its way in, mm-hmm. right? It's going to bleed in. And that, I think that's the mark of someone doing something very profound with a character, you know? I think that what I'm trying to do, it's probably in there in what I'm doing. It's not a focus of mine. Mm-hmm. You know, if anything, that story is concluded. So it's not like it can be the same guy. You know what I mean?
Right.
Mm-hmm. But you talked about Armor Wars. I mean, that's a story about Tony's paranoia, which is what's fascinating. That's a story about a selfish person. Right. And that's a story about a guy who's, I don't know, man, he's got an axe to grind or something to prove about his own abilities, and how special an individualist he is about his designs. That's amazing. You know, Civil War in the comics and in the movies, that's another guy who's a know-it-all, but it is also, there's a fear underneath that. There's a fear in Tony Stark that I think is fascinating, of being wrong. And that's something that is in our book, I think, a lot. But there's, you know, that in that fear of being wrong, there's a egocentricity to that. You know, even though it's all my fault, you know, that's a line that's going to come up in the Iron Man books that we're doing a lot. And in a way it is, it's true. And you think it's self-effacing, but it's also very self-focused. When you say it's all my fault, you rob other people in the situation of their agency, mm-hmm. and being part of the story. And it'll be a while before he realizes that, but there's an undercurrent of his ego even going on as he's trying to rectify his past arrogant deeds, you know? And then, yeah, I mean, my books, I can't write some things unless I wrote Silver Surfer, I'd maybe be able to do the full, like, Robert Heinlein, so, you know, serious. But outside of that, like, the book has to be funny. You know what I mean? And I think that it's going to be funny, and he's going to be funny, both to watch him and even sharpening his wit. You know, I just like to do that. It adds to the fun. I think Marvel has to be fun. There has to be a component of fun in their books, you know, and that's super important to me.
Yeah, I agree. And when you talk about egocentric, I mean, that's really the core of Tony, and always has been. Obviously, mm-hmm. RDJ brought that and manifested it in a different way on the silver screen, but that is the one common thread, or the most common thread, the most obvious common thread, I think, from all the way back in Iron Man 1 with, you know, him realizing, and this reflected in the movie, they just changed the war, you know, that, hey, my company's making weapons and people are dying, and, you know, mm-hmm. I'm going to be the one to fix it because I can't allow mm-hmm. anyone else to. And so that was there from the character from his earliest comic days and obviously in the movie. So it's great to hear that you're you know, you realize that you're such a fan of the character, and we're going to see that consistency continue.
I think I did the math, and my issue is actually number 625 of Iron Man. So that's a big kit of yeah. which you can go. That's a lot of different crayons to color with, right?
Yep.
Plus the movies, plus Tales of Suspense, plus, I don't know, the 60s cartoon. You can pull so much stuff in, right? I don't know. It's the best. It's the best pastiche, you know, thing you can engage with creatively, in my opinion, are comic book characters that have been around that long.
Yeah, and again, I know you realize how lucky you are, you know, being able to work on these characters, you know, Iron Man, Doctor Doom. I mean, they've been around forever, and that you know, they're known the world over. Really, really cool. And Kafu, I mentioned, your artist on that series, but you're also working with Salvador LaRocca on Doom, which that is just such a beautiful book. What are your reactions when pages come in? Are you just, again, that kid in the candy store?
Every day that pages come in is like Christmas, right? It's like you ordered something, like a toy from Amazon, right? Or like, but it's even better than that. It's like, and I mean, look, I can sit here and pontificate about the story all day, but it's the artist. I mean, this is an artist's medium. Mm-hmm. I mean, and to work with Martin Marazzo, Ian J. Culbert, Patrick Reynolds, Salvador, you know, and then Kafu, whose name I have not figured out how to pronounce yet because we're all email based and I've heard several different versions of it, but regardless, it's incredible. I mean, it elevates my Word document to something actually worth buying and reading.
Right.
You know, and they're also so gracious too. I mean, it's an amazing collaboration, and Salva was funny because he and I was blindsided by this. Like, we were nominated for an Eisner for Doom as best new series. And, you know, we lost to Karen Berger and Willow Wilson, the two people who actually brought me into comics, which was perfect and poetic. but I wrote Salva afterwards and I was like, we lost, you know. The book's beautiful though, you know, through 10. I'm so proud of it. And he was like, yeah, we lost. And he's like, have fun on Iron Man. He's like, I did win an Eisner for Iron Man. I was like, oh, that's true. So he didn't hesitate to remind me. But I mean, these are the best of the best, man. I mean, I just feel super lucky.
Well, I think it's well deserved, Chris. I mean, obviously, I'm a fan. I don't mean to gush. You realize how lucky you are, which I think is also amazing. But I'm sure the people that work with you are saying the same thing. Like, that the fact that you realize and you don't take for granted, and with everything you've been through, the struggles, I think it's well deserved, man. You've been so gracious with your time both times I've had you on, and so I really, really appreciate it. Looking forward to the continuation of Doom, and looking yeah. forward to Iron Man. And the door's always open. Anytime you want to come on and talk about anything, happy to have you.
Same, man. Give me a ring. And look, I'm so glad Doom's coming back. Where this story arc finishes, I think we do some awesome stuff. So in all the Iron Man noise, don't lose sight of old Victor. It's going to be rad.
Definitely not. Definitely not. The armored corner of the Marvel Universe is in
right.
good hands, Chris. So thanks again for your time, and we really appreciate it.
Awesome. Take care, man.
You bet. You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.